You're listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. On this last night of winter, first night of spring, the push to go electric has been picking up speed for years now, with the goal to make all new light vehicles sold in this country EVs by 2035. But are they money savers for the average driver right now? Well, that really depends. A study out this month, put together by researchers at the University of British Columbia, looked into when EVs make sense financially. And they came up with some pretty interesting discoveries. We find out what they are. Roberta Bondar became the first Canadian woman in space, the first neurologist in space back in January 1992. And that is just one of the many highlights and achievements on her incredible resume. She joins me to talk candidly about her time as an astronaut, her time with the Canadian Space Agency, her work as a conservationist, as well as an accomplished nature photographer, and her new book of photos out in September called Space for Birds, and much more. But first, spring has sprung at the earliest time in more than a century, 128 years to be exact, and it closes the book on what was the warmest winter, the warmest December, January, and February on record in Canada, 5.2 degrees Celsius above the norm since record keeping began back in 1948. That is 1.1 degree above the previous record. So what caused it, and what could it mean for the spring and summer ahead? Today marks the last day of winter. In fact, we're in the last few hours of winter right now, the last hour, more or less, at 11.06 p.m. Eastern, so 8.06 p.m. Pacific. Spring will have sprung. It's the earliest that it's been in over a century, 128 years for the vernal equinox. Part of that has to do with the leap year. Also, each year, it's sort of each leap year, it's going back a little bit. So the last time we had it this early was back in 2020, the last time we had a leap year. But here we are about to welcome in spring. But what a winter it was. If there's one sentiment that can describe the season we're saying goodbye to, it's warm. Not warm every day and not warm everywhere every day, but the months of December, January, and February were the warmest on record in this country. On average, the temperature over that three-month period was 5.2 degrees Celsius warmer than the norm since Canada began keeping records all the way back in 1948. The previous record was 15 years ago in 2009-10 when it was 4.1 degrees above the norm. So imagine 1.1 degrees above the previous record. The U.S. also recorded its warmest winter on record. Joining me now with more on this is David Phillips. He's senior climatologist at Environment and Climate Change Canada. Welcome back, David. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ben. Nice for inviting me aboard. I mean, we always love talking about the weather, and hey, it's a thing that Canadians it's nonstop talk.
It is indeed. And this year, I mean, what happened? I mean, this was the winter that wasn't.
Oh, exactly. Oh, Ben, I said it was the lost season. I mean, I've canceled a few summers, you know, with a forecast, but never winter. I mean, we're known as the northern people. I mean, the land of ice and snow and cold. And my gosh, that's who we are. I mean, it often, you feel lucky if it begins after Halloween and ends before Easter. But my gosh, this year, we look at December, January, February. That's how we, Environment Canada, defines the winter. And it was just nothing I've ever seen in my 50 years in the business. It was just absolutely warm right from the get-go. I mean, there were a few moments. I remember out in Edmonton, they had some pretty cold weather there in the middle of January for about 10 days. But that was pretty well it. And Ben, it was so persistently mild. I mean, you can find some 3 months of winter. Well, one is usually cold and the other is so-so. And maybe you might be lucky and get a protracted January thaw. But really, from the beginning of December right through to the end of February and then beyond, we have just seen incredible temperatures. In 77 years of weather records in Canada that we have, now we have records that go back in the centuries for various stations in the provinces, but not nationally. So we can compare the entire country over the last three quarters of a century, and no winter came close to even matching this one. I get excited, Ben, when we break a record by 0.1 of a degree. We broke the previous warmest year by 1.1 degrees. It was the warmest winter in North America, United States, the warmest in the globe. I mean, clearly, Canada was just like everybody else. It was just, and we were talking about it. My gosh, it was nonstop talk about where is winter. And there's a lot of thinking out there Ben, that, oh my gosh, we're going to pay for this. It's going to come back and bite us. And, you know, it's just, I kept saying, well, it's just delayed. No, it was canceled.
I mean, the Rideau Canal is always a bit of a bellwether when it comes to this. It managed to open for about 3 days before it melted. There was, you know, my dad's in Montreal. They have a cottage up north of Montreal. There was no snow. The ski hills were all suffering. I mean, we saw what was, I thought, interesting about it is that it was right across the country, more or less.
Well, that is true. I mean, you know, so often it's a huge country. And so therefore, I mean, it's hard to find the same weather. It's usually the West is basking in the sunlight, and the East is freezing in the dark. I mean, that is typically what we see. But from coast to coast to coast, I mean, it was absolutely, everybody was remarking about the same situation. And, you know, you raise a good point. I mean, there were winners and there were losers. I mean, we Canadians saved lots of money on their home heating bills. I mean, driving was easier and parking, finding parking spots. I mean, there were some advantages. And but boy, I think from the recreation business was just took a real hit. Skiers and snowmobilers and ice fishers. It was really just almost they just hung up their snowboards and their augers and that was it. There was just no, and even if you ventured out, it was unsafe conditions. Yeah, the snow was not very thick and the ice was thin and weak and it was just not good. And then we also saw, for example, couldn't build ice roads in the north. That had a big hit. And just absolutely the maple syrup scene. What could be more precious than that? We make the best maple syrup in the world.
We do. And it started really early. The sap was flowing in January, if I remember correctly. I mean, just from a meteorological point of view, what was happening? Why was it so warm?
Well, Ben, I think there were a couple of factors. First of all, we had a very warm year last year, the second warmest year on record in Canada, the warmest in the globe. So a lot of that residual heat in the lakes and the rivers and the land was left over. And so we got to the winter season. Well, it sort of moderated those kind of temperatures. The oceans, Ben, I mean, every ocean in the world was on a hot tub. It was warmer than normal, and particularly in the Atlantic. I saw a statistic where the Atlantic Ocean broke records every day in the last year. Never has it been so warm on every day. So that was a factor. And then, of course, El Nino. I mean, we talked about this. This was actually a supercharged, super-sized El Nino. It began very early, probably affected our weather last year, but clearly it did our winters like it always does. And no mistaken, it was probably in 80 years, the third largest, strongest El Nino, and that had a factor. And then, Ben, there is the backdrop or the background of climate change. I mean, the fact that our winters are not what they used to be. I mean, old timers always tell me, well, you know, it's not like it used to be. And they're absolutely right about that. The numbers don't lie. They're all saying the fact that every region of Canada is warmer in the winter than it was in the past. And I think all of those factors, Ben, were all kind of pushing in the same direction. There was no sort of counterbalance as there is sometime. They were all kind of pulling in the same strength, and therefore that is why it was the winter that wasn't.
David Phillips is with us this half hour, senior climatologist at Environment and Climate Change Canada. We're talking about the winter that wasn't as we arrive at spring 2024 and we look backwards in the rearview mirror. For most of the country, it was really a very mild winter. We weren't, there were some notable exceptions at notable times of the past 3 months, but overall, it was very warm, much warmer than, in fact, it beat the warmest previous record by about a degree, as David was pointing out. So, I mean, we've been talking about this already. We know there was no real ice on the Great Lakes. We know that there was fires still burning in BC and Alberta and elsewhere after a record wildfire season. With this kind of winter, what could this mean for the spring and summer ahead?
Well, Ben, I always say to people, like, you know, and a lot of people, I would say, Ben, if you took a poll across the country, there are a lot of people liking this winter. Sure. I mean, we saved lots of money and getting around was so much easier. And but I always say that, you know, the kind of weather you're blessing may be the weather you're cursing later on. There usually is not a connection from the weather from one season to the next. It's a little bit of an exception with winter to spring. But generally, in terms of the impacts, the effects, the fallout of this unnatural kind of situation, it really, you don't really know how you're going to pay for that. Newfoundlanders, they're great people. They always, whenever they get 3 good days in a row, they hide under the bed. They think nature's going to beat you up
Yes, I spent time
for
there, indeed. Yeah.
exactly. But, I certainly think that taking a full account of it, I mean, think of the fact that the bugs and the diseases and the pests, they all survive the
Ticks.
winter.
Yeah, ticks. So there's a lot
Exactly.
of talk about
And
that.
truly, and then also the pollen in the air, the trees have not budded and blossomed much earlier. And we're seeing physicians are already saying they have patients who used to come in May and complain about wheezing and gasping and respiratory problems from allergies. They're already complaining now. I mean, they're already seeing the effects of that. And of course, in the bigger term too is the drought situation. We didn't see a lot of precipitation to go with that warmer conditions, more evaporation. So any precipitation we got was sort of taken away from us from just evaporation. And so and we're dealing with evaporation not just in one growing season, Ben. It's like a multi-year kind of problem. And so this is very much a concern. The wildfires, we had these zombie fires, these fires that kind of come back and
Smolder, yeah, smolder through the winter.
they don't necessarily say you're going to have a forest fire kind of year, but it's just sort of indicative of the fact that the forest duff is dry, and so there's a greater risk of having forest fires. And a lot of the forest fire in the provinces, they've already started early in terms of hiring, getting ready. It used to be a summer kind of activity. It's becoming almost a year-round activity because of the kind of changing conditions. But water levels are down. And it just the impacts are kind of not known. We can describe the weather, and going forward, I mean, my gosh, I often think if you get a tough winter, then spring is a little slow to arrive. And that's because you've got to get rid of the snow and the ice before the warming can come. But this year, it's just our models say, hey, yes, you're right. Right now, as we speak, there are parts of eastern Canada and parts of the prairies are feeling winter. By the time we get to the end of March into April, our models, Ben, are showing like we saw last summer, this winter is warmer, warmer, warmer from coast to coast to coast. So I don't see any cold area temperatures. And we've even looked at summer. We can't believe it. And all the models, European, American models, and Canadian models, are saying, hey, more of the same. So El Nino may be not dead, but is dying. And it still has a sort of a lasting effect. The atmosphere, the ocean may be gone in terms of the warmth, but the atmosphere still feels that, and we see more of that coming. And just the fact that our seasons are warmer, Ben, it's almost as an easy forecast to say what the future is going to be.
David, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Ben, so much. Bye-bye now.
15, 12, 10, 9, 8, 7. We have a go for main engine start. We have 3 main engines up and running. 3, 2, 1, 0. And liftoff, liftoff of the Space Shuttle Discovery and the first International Microgravity Laboratory.
Houston is now controlling. Discovery and crew are rolling on course.
Roll program.
Roger, roll, Discovery.
The liftoff of Discovery, Space Shuttle Discovery, back in January of 1992. I imagine you, like me, like many of us, watched because it was such a big moment for this country. On board, of course, Dr. Roberta Bondar was blazing a trail for this country, becoming the first Canadian woman and the first neurologist in space. It was the culmination for her of a love of science and dreams of becoming an astronaut that were born in the basement of her childhood home in Sault Ste. Marie when her father built her a lab and encouraged her to be curious about the world and the mysteries that lay above. And her 8-day voyage on Discovery is just one of the incredible lists of achievements or incredible achievements through her 8 decades on this planet. She would later spend a decade as the head of an international space medicine research team collaborating with NASA. She's a Companion of the Order of Canada and the Order of Ontario. She received the NASA Space Flight Medal, dozens of honorary degrees, an induction to the Canadian Medical Hall of Fame, the International Women's Forum Hall of Fame, and she even has a star on Canada's Walk of Fame, the first astronaut to get one of those. But her time in space also reinforced her commitment to protecting the planet she saw from above. She became a renowned nature photographer in the past decades, focusing on the lives and habitats of two majestic bird species, the endangered whooping crane in North America and the near-threatened lesser flamingo in Africa. She's traveled all around taking photographs of those birds and others. She's been touring some of those photos across the country of late, and that has culminated in a new book of her photos due out in September called Space for Birds, Patterns and Parallels of Beauty and Flight. She has become a vocal conservationist through the Roberta Bondar Foundation. Add it all up, and her list of achievements and accomplishments is almost unparalleled, certainly in this country. And she's been an inspiration to many, including Jenny Gibbons, who is the third woman in the Canadian space program after Dr. Bondar and Julie Payette, and selected last year to be the backup to Jeremy Hansen as Canada's representative on the Artemis II lunar mission. But Dr. Bondar is candid about the challenges she faced being the first woman in what had long been a male-dominated domain, especially attitudes within the Canadian Space Agency itself. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Roberta Bondar to the show. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Pleasure. Thanks for asking me on. Thank you.
You know, I'd seen interviews with you in the past and how passionate you were about returning to the moon and how that would bring back excitement in space. And I think we had Jeremy Hansen on the show 6 months ago, and it was palpable how excited people were about this whole Artemis mission and so on. I was wondering what your thoughts were, because it sort of proved true what you'd been saying for quite a while.
Actually, I'm thrilled for Jeremy and also for Jenny, who's his backup. I think that of all the adventures that we've had as Canadians, as human beings going into space, I think this is probably one of the most challenging. And I say that not because there's anything to take away from the other flights of myself and other Canadians, but rather this is a different category. It's built obviously upon our missions and our experience, but it's on a rocket that's only flown once before. That in itself, the whole difficulty of getting off the planet is not to be underrated. I just think that the people who are going past Earth's orbit, especially for the first time on a vehicle that to me is not has not been proven a lot, I think it's very heroic.
Yeah, it takes me back, of course, to watching your flight back in 1992, because, you know, as a child who was just coming out, I was just coming out of high school, and we had all watched the Challenger disaster. And you know, there was the sense that somehow that the, I think for Gen X, there was this sort of idea that space flight had become safe. And then we were reminded of the inherent dangers. And you point out, of course, they still exist, because it'll always be with risk.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even when I was growing up, and I was in the age of the Apollo astronauts, Gemini, Mercury, and it was a time when I was growing up when nothing had left the surface of the planet, so everything was dangerous, just getting up there. And that hasn't changed that much. I mean, if we look at even the in quotes unquote space tourism component to space exploration now, I mean, people pay to go up. They pay to have these risks. But nonetheless, it's an era where people still have trouble getting up into space for long periods of time. I mean, people want to go to Mars, and I have said for many, many years that to go to Mars directly is foolhardy, that we don't know enough, and that going to the moon would be the obvious thing.
I mean, there's so much we could talk about. One of the things that strikes me, too, is just how much over the course of your career space had been a forum for cooperation, for international cooperation. Even at the height of the Cold War, sort of the end of the Cold War, I should say, it was still there. It feels as if it's hanging on right now, but we're seeing more competition. And I wonder whether you worked obviously with the Russians, and now the Chinese are in the mix and so on. But it seems like we're entering a different era in space, where there's both cooperation in the spirit of what existed in the past, but also sort of a new kind of Cold War in space as well.
It's an interesting point you raise. One of the things that I've been trying to get a bit more information on, just from my own personal education, is the whole issue of the U.S. Space Force, the new part of the Air Force that deals with more militaristic uses of space and how to protect a country and an idea. But of course, there's also problems on the ground, too. I mean, there's horrendous problems with war and I would hope that having different countries and different cultures going to space, people keep touting the space station as being the ultimate way of breaching walls for the Cold War, that you have Russians going up there and Americans going up, the Canadians, whatever, but non-Russians, and they get along in space. I think after a while, people become a different country in itself. I mean, the International Space Station becomes what we would define as a country down here. So there isn't a Cold War. It's people just getting along and have a common purpose, and that's to stay alive. And then the next purpose would be to do something while they're there. So when we see other cultures, we see other opportunities for this to branch out, and it would be good if it touched more people on the planet. The problem is, on the planet, we have other things that, such as religion and other cultures and historical things, that are very, very difficult to cross these boundaries and borders.
Yeah, you've talked about this in the past, obviously, about what it's like to be above the Earth and to look down on it and to get that perspective of what's on the planet, how it sort of opens your eyes to so much of the other stuff. And but before we got there, I wanted to ask you a bit about the work that you did on that 1992 mission, because so much of what we've tried to understand about going to the moon, for instance, and then potentially going to Mars later, is a lot of what you were already exploring and researching when you went up in 1992.
Yes, I mean, we just because people think there are a lot more people going into space and a lot more flights, it doesn't mean we have a lot more data.
You know? Right.
And it's very, very, I mean, it's not a controlled experiment. So when we see people floating around in space, we know there is some bone loss. We know there are heart issues. We know there are cardiac issues for sure going up and coming back, let alone just in space. We also know besides radiation and bone loss, we're finding things now more worrying about immunity in space, so that when you're up for a little bit, that maybe it doesn't bother you as much, but on a prolonged basis, which would be going to Mars, for example, or staying on the moon a long time, there are things that change that make people less capable of fighting off bacteria or viruses or other unknown organisms that could invade the human tissue. And if we don't know about these things, to me, it's unethical to put people at such high risk going so far away from the planet that there's really no ability to rescue them in any logical, safe, ethical manner.
Do you think we're there yet? Because I know I heard you speaking about sight loss and so on. There's things that we learn every time people are in space for an extended period of time.
Yes. One of the things that we do face a lot, and I'm a woman, so I can say this, is that we don't have the representation of gender that we need to. And I'm not trying to say here that we need 50 men and 50 women on some Mars mission. But if we have any just distribution of genders on a mission to go that far into space, we really need to have the understanding of what that organism is going to deal with. So there are those kinds of things that make people uncomfortable to say, hey, you're not going to have this out or the other go wrong with you. And there is a longitudinal study of astronaut health that even my small mission I'm still part of, examined every year, because we don't know where the links are between what we perceive on the ground as being healthful living and what you can get away with going into space and coming back to the planet, just in terms of radiation. So we'd like to know that cancers, for example, don't have an increased rate amongst returning astronauts from certain lengths of time in space. That's just one small example.
When I was growing up, Roberta Bondar was really important to me. She was this amazing role model as Canada's first female astronaut, inspiring me to pursue a career in science.
Dr. Roberta Bondar is with us, as she, of course, the first Canadian woman in space back in 1992. Many of us who were there will remember those 8 days well, the first neurologist as well. Dr. Bondar, when you look back at those 8 days, I know you talked a lot about it on the anniversary, and I've just heard some incredible questions about it. How do you reflect on it as the years go on? Because I wonder how that evolves over time.
It's interesting. I guess I'm at a certain age where I look back now at some of the other things I've done and wonder how I can leverage them going forward, not leverage them in terms of making money, but leverage them in terms of my health or understanding or passing information on to other people. So I reflect back and think about what I've accomplished since that space flight. And honestly, it does not feel like 30 years. And people who get to be my age always say that. And people are young going, yeah, I'll never be like that. Well, guess what? You will. I'd love to be able to go back and whisper in my ear when I 30 some years ago and say some of the stuff to me that I probably would have been very nice to hear, but I didn't have. There was no, I was on the prow of a ship, right? There was nobody else giving me some guidance about what truly I should put up with and what truly I should not put up with.
Yeah. So, I mean, what advice would you whisper to yourself? Because I mean, I've looked back at it now, and it does feel a while back. I mean, I was around for it. So, but it does feel. I mean, 1992. Unfortunately, some people say, "Oh, you know, it happened 10 years ago." I'm like, right, in the '90s. No, like 30 years ago. Now.
I know. It'll catch up to you. Well, it's the kinds of things I would have probably would have given my advice is that I was the only woman on my flight. Mm-hmm. I was the only woman in the Canadian astronaut program. Pretty well the day after I came back to Ottawa, I was hauled into a conference room and basically was told that I wasn't going to be sent for mission specialist training like everybody else was being sent. Like, why? There's an expression in the movie, The Right Stuff. I didn't screw the pooch.
Yes.
I didn't do anything wrong. I did everything right. And how could they do this? And I had no one to go to. There was no ombudsman. There was not no one. I mean, I tried the channels, but I didn't know anybody outside of having been the first Canadian woman in space and the world's first neurologist and being feted outside my country. Inside my country, these people at the agency who had power, they were men as far as I know, all were, I don't know, how could they be disgruntled? But they were. And basically would not allow me to carry on the career. And so it's hard these days when I go around telling people about, well, you can have your dream, but you got to do this, you got to do that. These are the kinds of things that I would tell my green younger person to do it differently, because now I know how I would do it at my age with the wisdom that I have over the years. But back then, I had no clue, no idea. I didn't know what to do. It was before social media. It was before it was really before a lot of internet stuff. So it was kind of hard to defend oneself and try to say, you guys are we're on the radio, and I won't say what I would think, but basically, I wouldn't put up with it. There was nothing I could do. That's what was so frustrating, is that it just appeared that I was never going to fly again. And so it took me many years to try to deal with that. I mean, I had to support, I didn't have to, but I supported space medicine research as the head of an international team with NASA for about 10 years. Supporting, I don't know, 14 flights or something with cosmonauts. I was in Star City. But when the Canadians went on their flights and I saw them after, they never volunteered to do these experiments. It was always the Russians or Americans. And so it became a thing, you know, it was a thing.
Interesting.
And when I walked away from that, I just decided I had to do something different. I wanted to use the space feeling of looking at the earth in space. I wanted to keep that very personal connection that I had, the love of research, but anything to do with the space agency, I just completely walked away from because they walked away from me.
Which is interesting because I know at the time there was so much, I don't know if there was pressure, but there was certainly the impression from those on the outside that was a lot was asked of you post-mission to go out and sort of sing from the songbook and encourage people to get involved and sort of gloss over any of the issues because that's the story people wanted to hear.
Well, you know, my parents, my mom was, my dad died before I flew, but my mother was a teacher and she was very much into taking the high road and trying to make other people comfortable and happy. I always felt that I can't tell people the truth because I don't want to discourage people from thinking that space is a great thing. It wasn't the space wasn't the problem. It was the political view of maybe not having two North Stars. I don't know. They had a male that was they had a male from the armed forces. It was an engineer. I was a female from medicine. I wasn't in the armed forces. So who knows? I never knew. And so I did find it hard to go out and talk about the space program. I had to go back to why I wanted to go in the space program and the kinds of things that energized me as a child, because I'm speaking to children, I'm speaking to young people who want to do something with their lives that's space related, whether it's being an astronaut or creating some robotic system that's going to go to Jupiter. I don't know. But I don't want to stick a pin in their balloon. I want them soul to take that balloon and free float all around and see things and gain their own experience and expertise and their own challenges. I can't fight them for them, but I certainly can't. I don't want to depress people No. because of a negative experience that I had. But on the other hand, there's a time when if I'm asked about have I been treated not the same as men, then I'd say absolutely.
When I first came over Canada, it was the biggest show imaginable, winter or no winter. It has to be, it's just absolutely beautiful and spectacular. And I'm coming back to Earth with a feeling that there is absolutely nothing boring. There is no boring place anywhere in this whole planet.
Dr. Roberta Bondar is with me this hour. We're talking about many things. The first Canadian woman in space, of course, back in 1992. The first neurologist in space. We've been talking about her experiences in space with the space agency. I was looking back, and I knew this already, but I was looking back. I'd forgotten, of course, that you'd gone to Guelph back in the late 60s, and you'd studied zoology. This was sort of your first love. You were very much grounded on the Earth. So it wasn't a big surprise when I was starting to look at your photos and so on that you found this of your many other pursuits and passions, that one of them has really been about conservation and beauty and flight and sort of focusing on a few different species. But tell me a bit about that work you've been doing, because it's fascinating work and it's really taken you all over the planet. And part of it was inspired by what you'd seen from above 30 some odd years ago now.
Yes, absolutely. I was on an international mission. So I was able to connect even before I flew with a number of different countries and a number of different cultures. I just felt that when I was in space, it's an individual moment that a person has. I mean, I can't say what other astronauts think or feel. I just can tell you that just to be in space and to see the edge of the planet and for the first time in my life, actually appreciate that it is a planet and know what a planet means. It's not the three-dimensional globes. It's not something on a big screen, it's an IMAX movie, although we try so hard to simulate it. It's actually seeing the edge of the Earth. I mean, you don't know you're on a planet till you see the edge of it. And that's what that influenced me. And I don't know, maybe this is too much to talk about, but I know when William Shatner went up on that.
William Shatner, of course, on that Jeff Bezos thing.
Right. So when he came back from his brief moments in space, he came, I'm sure that he had a speech. He's an actor. He would have something prepared when he landed. He got off that thing, and Jeff Bezos was coming up to shake his hand and everything. And Shatner looked stunned, like absolutely stunned. And all he could do was talk about sort of the thin blue line that he could see above the planet. And he says, that's all that's stopping us. It's all preventing us from like this big universe that he was this actor about for decades. And he comes and he wants to talk about this. This is the emotion he had. And Jeff Bezos looks at him and he walks off and gets a bottle of champagne and starts spraying it over everybody. Yeah. I mean, like it was just, and William Shatner sort of stood back. But I think that was the real moment that people can have by seeing the planet. So I was quite affected by the idea that this was a very limited resource here. I had a very limited life, but the Earth had gone on before me and the Earth will go on after me. But what can I do while I'm here? Is there something I can do to get people feeling better about the planet? And I did not want to get into a place where I was going around taking pictures of the bad things. I go to the part where if you love something, you'll want to protect it. So one of the first thing I wanted to do after I finished up my space research activities was to go across the country like Ansel Adams had done in the States back in the 30s and 40s with black and white cameras. They didn't really know what national parks meant, but as soon as he did this, then people identified with Yosemite, for example, Yellowstone. They identified with the West, and that became part of the soul of American people. And I thought, well, I'm not Ansel Adams, but I'm going to do the same kind of thing in Canada, but I'm going to do it in color because I saw the planet in color. Mm-hmm. And away from the planet, it was that light-sucking black, the stars that didn't twinkle, dead light from thousands of years ago. So black and white did not interest me, although someone said to me years after, you should have done things in black and white. It's much more mysterious. I thought, no, I'm talking about beauty on the planet. So I'll take my camera. So I studied professional nature photography, even though I had worked with cameras from the time I was like 10 years of age. I always had cameras. I used them in my PhD work, my MD work. Everything I did professionally was always with electron microscopy, photomicrography. I just did it all. And so when it came to doing these bellows cameras, taking them across the country, I thought, well, I better learn how to use one of these suckers first. And so then I mortgaged my house and went across the country and actually took these beautiful panoramic images, that's a collection of images for a book called Passionate Vision that Mr. Trudeau Sr. had written the introduction for, mm-hmm. not the introduction, the foreword for. And then after that, you're right. I mean, I came back to my zoological roots and started thinking about life on the planet. And I thought, I just love flight. And I love birds since I was a little girl. And this is the time to think about the environment. And I went on a helicopter flight when I was in Wood Buffalo National Park, when we were looking at a place for the foundations, one of our programs with Indigenous students in the wilderness. And the pilot said, let's just fly over this area because we're doing this survey with the whooping cranes. Now, when I was born, the whooping cranes were down to like 14 adults, and too young to fly over this area and to see a whooping crane pair. And you don't see another pair for like 50 kilometers because they're so solitary. And this was an unknown at the time I was born. No one knew where they nested. They'd been pushed out of the prairies. So that started this whole thing about bird migration. And then I was working with the UNEP folks, and we identified the Lesser Flamingo as another bird that we wanted to follow. And so we've got seven birds. We haven't followed, there are three of them, we haven't had a lot of time devoted to them because it's taken 10 years to do the Lesser Flamingo and the Whooping Crane. And it's creating these artistic images of habitat so that people will see what these birds need. And then I have these wonderful images from the International Space Station, and a lot of my colleagues, including David Saint-Jacques, he photographed them specifically for this project when he was in space. And then NASA just did a whole bunch more. So that's what the book is. It's combining those two species to make people believe that there is other life out there that's worth protecting.
I understand that you caught a glimpse of Canada during your mission.
Let me tell you, it's exceptionally exciting from space. Every mile of this beautiful country.
Dr. Roberta Bondar is with me. We're talking about right now about her book coming out in September called Space for Birds, Patterns and Parallels of Beauty and Flight. We've been talking about space, going to space. Of course, Dr. Bondar spent 8 days in space back in 1992 on a shuttle mission. The first neurologist as well, the first Canadian woman. Dr. Bondar, when I look back at all, what next? There's so much that you've done. There's so much that it's hard sometimes to narrow it down, even for an interview, because you think, oh, there's a million things we could talk about. But what would be next on your bucket list?
Well, I'm just continuing to do this bird migratory project. We have a traveling exhibition that not only includes the whooping crane and lesser flamingo, we also have the piping plover, which has two or three populations in North America, and one of it is in the Great Lakes, and there are about 200 of these piping plovers left that are endangered. They're very small birds. They can't. We can photograph the habitat from the air, but not likely the birds themselves. They're very small. They nest on the beach, in Wasaga Beach, for example, on Lake Huron. I think the first time I saw them, I thought, what a lovely little bird. And they're, you know, birds probably themselves don't want to be called cute. It's sort of like dressing up a dog for Halloween. I don't know. It's I don't know what these life forms are thinking, yeah. But I know if I was a bird, I don't know if I'd want to be called cute.
I'm fierce. Yeah, this little bird thinks I'm fierce.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I just will carry on doing that. I keep shifting my cameras around depending on the technology. So I just challenge myself. I have the drafts of two other books, and one I'd really like to dissect and have at it again. I mean, a lot of writers will tell you that they have a number of different projects in the drawers, and I'm no different than that. I mean, I will continue to do my photography. I'm really enjoying the videography as well. My dad always had 8mm movies when I was growing up, and he was doing these two-shot things when I was like six. He was doing all kinds of innovative things with his camera. And I've fallen in love with slow motion for these birds. Oh. I've fallen in love with the idea of the fact that one of the reasons why people may not think of birds is because they don't see them very much, right? And so I'm trying, I thought the video is people like movement. So I'm doing a lot of like 120 frames per second is the current technology to take slow motion of birds that are moving so fast that you can't see some of the things that they need to do and that they are doing in order to survive. And they become, I think, quite interesting to people to slow them down. Because if they flit around, people just don't, that's just a bird. But if you slow life down long enough for people to see things, then perhaps they will have a story that they can create for themselves. And that's sort of what I'm doing now.
Perspective, right? I mean, that's the interesting thing about everything you talk about is that it's perspective. Seeing the earth from above gives you perspective on earth. Seeing a bird slow down gives you a new perspective. It gives you a new line of sight into something that you might take for granted otherwise.
Absolutely.
This is a ridiculous question to ask you, by the way, but if there's one thing that has really taken your breath away after all the things you've seen, hanging out of helicopters, following migratory bird patterns, seeing the earth from above and so on, is there a breathtaking moment that still stands with you?
Well, I think seeing these birds that I've read about and I've never, ever seen, every time I see one, it does take my breath away to see them in 3D. I don't know how to get that feeling for people to have. I mean, I don't expect everybody to wander around and feel thrilled to see, necessarily see the first robin of spring when I know some of them hang around in the winter anyway. But to be able to see those whipping cranes from the air, to be able to see the lesser flamingo after hours and hours and days of driving to Lake Natron in Tanzania at 40 degrees without air conditioning, to actually see them in the feather, can't see them in the flesh, but see them in the feather on the flesh.
Right.
Those are the kinds of things, seeing things in the natural world that I've read about and not had a chance to see yet. It's like seeing the earth from space. I'm there, it's a planet. I'm looking outside and thinking, oh yeah, there are clouds, but I've been above those clouds. I've been above this earth and I have seen the edge of it. What can I see now that's on the earth that was hidden from me?
You still sound very optimistic, Dr. Bonder. I have to say, I know how much you've seen and how much you've been through, but you still come at all this with a lot of curiosity and a lot of optimism. I would suspect you'd have to.
I do. I know I don't take being a role model lightly. I don't take being a source of inspiration lightly. I'd like people to feel inspired that there's something that they can do to make somebody else happy, to make someone else more comfortable. If it's a friend who has cancer, that's no reason to walk away from them. If my friends are sick, I will call them. And I know I'm a doctor, but my mother always, and my father too, but probably more my mother because she's a bit more engaged in students. She would always try to make things fun. She would turn situations around so that people wouldn't feel uncomfortable. She would try to make things right when she knew she probably couldn't, but she would not walk away from it. I'm from a city that had a residential school.
Right, Sault Ste. Marie.
And that's right, and the Shinwalk. And I remember going to Shinwalk, and we had a girls' group, and my mother was doing everything she could to get new clothes for these students. And there was always a sort of a, in those days, what they call them, an Indian buyer or whatever, who would buy the clothes for these young students. And my mother would say, this is wrong. So my mother would buy bead needles for them, and they would teach us Cree, and they would teach us beading. And we'd get them out of the building anytime we could. We'd take them on picnics, or we'd take them to do things, and we'd try to learn from them. My mother was always doing stuff. And so when I went to Chisasibe a few years ago to give a talk to the science fair, I was met at the plane by a woman who had this old yellowed photograph of my sister, me, and her when she was young, she was probably about 12 or 13, in plastic. And she was carrying this and holding this high. And when I flew in space, she ran around she ran around everywhere with this because it was us together. It's the kind of thing that your place in life isn't just about you. It's about other people. And it's about making the world a better place.
Dr. Bondar, it's been a great pleasure as always. Thank you for sharing your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
This is the time of month when we always find out what the inflation numbers were for the month before. This is something that I have to say that nobody paid attention to for a very long time. for a very long time, no one paid attention to what the inflation numbers were because they never really changed. Now we pay a lot more attention to them. And in fact, a lot of the prognosticators were sort of thinking 3.1. Instead, they came in at 2.8% for last month. And that was despite forecasters who had widely expected an acceleration in price growth. So Canada's annual inflation rate cooled to 2.8% in February. Why? It was helped by slower growth in the cost of cellular services, go figure, groceries, imagine, and internet access services, all the things we like to rail about in this country, the telcos, grocery stores, and so on. Those were all down a little bit. Again, Stats Canada said Tuesday, economists had largely expected the rate to rise about 3.1% and undo some of the year's early progress. Rent and mortgage interest costs continued to be the primary drivers of inflation. The mortgage cost, there's a bit of irony in there, of course, because the Bank of Canada has pushed up interest rates, obviously, to try to keep to tamp down inflation. And instead, right now, mortgage interest costs are one of the major drivers of it. Here's CIBC economist Catherine Judge.
This is an unambiguously good report from the Bank of Canada's perspective. It essentially shows that high interest rates are working to tame inflation, which is what they're looking for to start cutting interest rates. It shows that the weakness in the economy that we've seen over the past year is feeding through to inflation data. So essentially, you have weak demand holding back inflation, which is what the Bank of Canada is looking for.
Indeed, the bank, of course, has held its key interest rate at 5% for months now. It is expected perhaps to begin cutting rates around the middle of the year. We'll find out. The next meeting is coming up in April. So we'll find out then about what they think, where they think this is all headed. But are those numbers, what's behind those numbers? That's what's always interesting to me. What is underlying those numbers? And is it as rosy as perhaps they appear? Don Drummond is the Stauffer Dunning Fellow at Queen's University and a former chief economist at TD Bank. And he joins me now from Arizona. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you very much.
I guess just your initial reaction to these numbers today.
Well, I don't tend to pay a lot of attention to what we call the headline number, the 2.8% year over year. I tend to go straight to what's my bottom line, and that's the measures of underlying inflation, in particular the three measures of the Bank of Canada. The good news is they went down from what we've seen recently. The not so good news is they're still in the low 3%. So I think I would certainly like to see those get a lot closer to the 2% inflation target. I'm sure the Bank of Canada would like to see them get a lot closer to the inflation target as well. So it's good news. I mean, we've come off an 8% inflation rate not that long ago, and we're down into the less than 3%. And as people notice, it's within the Bank of Canada 1% to 3% range. But the underlying inflation numbers are still a little bit toasty. And we can't forget the last labor force survey still said that wages are increasing at 5%. So things are getting better, but inflation is still a bit sticky.
Is this a slowly but surely thing, or is it we don't quite know?
I think it is slowly but surely, particularly because we tend to put a lot of emphasis on this year-over-year measure, and that, of course, has a lot to do with what happened many, many months ago. When we look at the last number of months, you know, for example, the last month, the seasonally adjusted increase was only 0.1. That's very good. So the current numbers are definitely helpful. I think we have there's a really interesting issue behind this. One of the major factors pushing up inflation, it's a bit ironic, is mortgage costs.
Right.
So you have this difficulty of the Bank of Canada. You've only got one policy instrument to try to lower inflation, but your one instrument is one of the major causes of inflation. So mortgage costs are up over 20% on a year-over-year basis. They're adding quite a bit to the overall rate of inflation. If you view the Bank of Canada as supposed to be forward-looking, you know that at some point that is going to flatten out and go down, but not for a while. The nature of fixed-term mortgages and even some of the people that are variable-rate mortgages, which had their payments fixed, we know that with the lags, that's going to continue to go up for a while. So if you're sitting there, Bank of Canada, how much weight should you put on the inflationary force from the interest rates themselves? If you see through that, then, you know, we are around the 2% target. So it's not bad. But if you look at it from the economy's perspective, the economy is pretty much going sideways. If you look at it, what I think we should shift around to look at it per person. You know, we've never really looked at gross domestic product per person because population tended to increase modestly, but the population increase in the last year is about 3%. So if we look at it on a per person basis, the economy is going down quite a bit in real terms. So that is weakening, but the level's still relatively high. The unemployment rate's creeping up, but the level's still relatively low. So again, if we look at it from the bank perspective, that's definitely promising. They said in their third quarter outlook from 2023, for the first time, aggregate demand was less than aggregate supply. So that's got to be refreshing. So I think things are lining up, but we haven't really got there yet. And we don't have the tangible proof that we're going to get there.
Interesting. I mean, you mentioned the mortgage costs, which I thought was interesting as well. And rents, of course, is another one that's been driving this up. What are some of the factors at play that have suddenly stabilized over the last few months that have allowed this to sort of, at least year over year, come down below that 3% level?
Well, the big thing, and probably the most important thing from a household perspective in the consumer price index, is food bought in stores. That has been the primary source of inflation. And let's face it, when it really comes down to the bottom line and your budget squeezed, that's the item that you really can't do too much about. You can try to buy lower price items, but that is really the necessity of life. And that has been for many years the primary driver of inflation. I really like how the Daily puts it, because they say, on the one hand, the rate of inflation for food purchases is down an awful lot. Secondly, it's the first time in a long time that food inflation is less than the general rate of inflation. But in the very next breath, they point out food prices are still incredibly high. And they point out the increase in the level of food prices over the last 2 years and how extraordinarily high that is. So, you know, that's still a problem. It's still a major source of squeezing households' budgets. But that's the good news, I think, behind this. We're finally getting, it's not even relief. I mean, food prices still went up. They just didn't go up that much in February.
Yeah. I know that you've been away for a bit. Are you noticing the same thing? I'm curious. Are you noticing the same thing in Arizona, for instance, that you were noticing back here?
Yeah, and I do. And it's interesting. For example, the CPI in the United States doesn't include mortgage costs. So if we measured it the way the United States does, we might have lower inflation. But the big difference between the Canada and the United States is not so much in the inflation numbers as the United States economy. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you could say it's, if not red hot, it's certainly some color of hot. It has shown remarkable resilience to the higher interest rates. The gross domestic product, the unemployment rate is very low. And yet the mood of the American consumer is very somber.
Yeah, and that's what I was curious about. Yeah, because it's, sort of, it's to do with grocery prices and mortgage payments and so on.
Well, I always feel if you're in a place, you've got to sort of immerse yourself in their news. And that. So I read the Arizona Republic, I need the New York Times, and there's article after article perplexed. So here's the statistics that indicate the U.S. economy is doing very well. Here's the statistics on the mood of consumers. How does one lead to the other?
And you're seeing it here, too. So even as these numbers fall, I think people's overall perception, I think there was a study out this week that said, you know, grocery prices, I think, are up 22% since March of 2020. But
right.
we think they're up 80%. Like, that's our perception.
Well, I did an interesting exercise one time when I was at TD Bank, because as we went around and talked to people, they almost all thought that their own personal rate of inflation was much higher than the measured rate. And in fact, they just didn't have any confidence in the measured rate at all. So we did this little game, and we took a really unrepresentative weighting. Like for example, if you're a smoker, you want a high weight on cigarettes. If you're not a smoker, you don't want any weight. If you're a renter, you want a high rate of rent. So we picked all these things. Let's pick somebody whose lifestyle is really oriented to stuff that's going up a lot of inflation. And let's pick somebody whose lifestyle is really skewed towards things that are not. And we never got that much variance.
Interesting. So,
but people, you know, people, one of the things that people forget, I give the example, you just bought a 60-inch television. What did you pay for that?
Oh, you paid probably a third of what you would have 20 years ago. Yeah.
And then I go, I'm going to remind you, when I was 16 years old and I accessed the 10% discount at Sears, I bought my parents a television, and it was a 16-inch black and white. and it cost about the same thing as your high definition 16-inch television.
Yeah.
So don't forget that stuff as well.
Yeah, the brain plays a big role. I mean, memory in the brain plays a big role in all this, doesn't it? Perception.
My first computer, which has less power than is in my phone, was $4,000 in 1982.
Don Drummond is the Stauffer Dunning Fellow at Queen's University, former chief economist at TD Bank. We're talking about the consumer price index. Inflation rose 2.8% in February. That's year over year. That's down a little bit from January when it was 2.9% and a little bit below expectations that were above 3%. So this is the second consecutive month that CPI growth has undershot estimates on Bay Street. But Don Drummond's been pointing out that some of the numbers underlying the numbers there, and it's still pretty steady. But Don, if you're the Bank of Canada now, and I know a lot of mortgage holders have been waiting months for this to happen. But if you're the Bank of Canada now and you're looking at these numbers, are you satisfied for April that maybe this is time to either sort of flag an upcoming cut or actually make the cut?
I'm going to take the very painful position of sitting on the fence.
Of course.
I think they could credibly defend either one.
Right.
They could really say that we're supposed to be forward-looking and we're going to be forward-looking and we're going to extrapolate these pretty positive numbers of recent months and we're going to go for it. It's just one and then we'll pause for a while and we'll see how that works. But on the other hand, they could say, you know, here's our three measures of underlying inflation and they're still over 1% and we did not like that wage increase. It's pretty sticky around the 5%. We have very little productivity gain. So unit labor costs are increasing well above the rate of inflation. Yes, the economy slowed down. Yes, for the first time in a couple of years, we actually have an output gap, but it's pretty small and we're going to wait. I think there's an additional element of intrigue. I don't know why, but the government of Canada has chosen the budget date 6 days afterwards.
Right.
I actually think that might backfire on the government because the Bank of Canada might be worried the budget's going to have yet more spending. And maybe they want to wait and see the budget before they make a decision.
Yeah, it's interesting because you mentioned mortgage costs are actually driving up inflation a little bit. At the same time, what would be the unintended consequences that of going too early on this rate cut?
I think it's a classic human behavior. If you've made one mistake, you're going to do everything in your power to not make the same mistake again. And even if that opens you up to making a mistake in the other direction, you know, if you've sliced your 99 drives in a row, you're maybe going to try to not hit one straight, but maybe hit a hook. And it's the same thing. The Bank of Canada should feel burned. They let inflation get out of control. They kept interest rates too low for too long. I think the worst outcome for them is they lower interest rates and inflation doesn't go down to the target. I think they'd be willing to entertain that maybe they keep them up too high for too long. It's that classic thing. You've made the mistake in one direction. Let's not do the same direction again. That would be really embarrassing to them if a year or two from now they had some interest rates to cuts and inflation was still a problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, I think all the conversations we've had and I've had with others, I mean, it's been getting difficult for them. This is sort of uncharted territory in some way, what they're looking at out there. And as you mentioned, they're under the spotlight, so they don't want to make the wrong call.
Yeah, and, you know, we'll really segregate people from age because I know the tendency is to think interest rates are extraordinarily high, but then you're speaking to somebody whose first mortgage was in 1982 at 17%. That kind of gives a perspective. Yeah,
just like your TV. Yeah.
Well, you know, they're way higher than they have been for a long time, but they're not particularly high. And yeah. I think that bears into the decisions from the monetary authorities as well.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting spring, I think, on the housing market because you see sort of flickers of activity, but everyone's still kind of sitting on the fence. And I wonder if today's numbers won't encourage people to wait just a little bit longer.
Well, the interesting thing about mortgages is, of course, the variable mortgages have almost disappeared. They were the predominant form not too long ago. And with the interest rate increases, they've gone up. But the fixed mortgage rates are not driven by the Bank of Canada rate, but bond yields.
Right.
And bond yields have while they've gone up, they've remained relatively low and they've gone down recently. So the decline in the Bank of Canada decision may or may not directly lower interest rates. It may revive the variable rate mortgage market, but I think that probably won't happen for a while. But if you're going to go for a five-year mortgage, that's going to get driven off the five-year bond yield. And that's not that heavily influenced by the Bank of Canada. In fact, it could even be inverse if the markets were concerned the Bank of Canada was going too early in interest rates, they actually may put pressure on the for the longer term yields to go up.
Interesting. I last thing I was going to ask, I noticed because I think I covered this 15 years ago when I was in Asia, the Bank of Japan scrapped their negative interest rate for the first time. I mean, that was a bit of an eye opener.
I think you have to realize if you've been following up that's sort of that thing, doing the same thing but expecting a different outcome. They've been following this policy since 1990. It hasn't worked.
That's a long time. Yeah.
Well, and I would bring that back home in Canada, the United States. I mean, they've followed this super low interest rate policy for about two decades. What did it do? It created a housing bubble. It created a hugely indebted consumer market. I don't think it worked very well here either. And it created this inflation problem to a great degree. So, I've always said the Bank of Canada should be a very easy job. You should basically just keep interest rates at neutral and somewhere around the 2-3% for the short-term interest rate, and then put your feet up in your desk. And yeah, every once in a while, you got to come in and straighten things back. But I don't think they should be all that activist or all that interventionist. And the examples when they've tried to do it, Japan, Canada, United States more recently, didn't work out very well.
Don, as always, thank you. Enjoy your time in Arizona.
Thank you.
The push to go electric has been in high gear for some time now in this country. As you'll know, the federal government's targets are pretty ambitious. Ottawa has set goals of 100% zero-emission vehicle sales by 2035 for all new light-duty vehicles, including interim targets of at least 20% by 2026. That's coming up quick. And at least 60% by 2030. Last year, just under 11% of newly registered vehicles in this country were so-called zero-emission vehicles. The first time the 10% mark has been passed, that according to Stats Can. Sales growth actually picked up speed in the last quarter of last year, with 12% of new car buyers opting for zero-emission vehicles. So it is getting more and more popular. A lot of that, you'll understand, is in places where there are incentives in place. BC, EV sales as a proportion of all sales in BC were highest in 2023 in BC at 20.2%. So already BC is selling 20% of cars sold in this country, or this province rather, one in five are ZEVs, with 18.6% in Quebec and 7.4% in Ontario, even though there are more actual individual EVs being sold in Quebec right now. But are they a money saver now in the long run? Well, that may depend. A study out this month put together by researchers at the University of British Columbia looked into it and when EVs begin to make sense financially. And they came up with some pretty interesting findings. Joining me now is Bassem Javed. He's a sessional instructor and PhD candidate at UBC, and he led this very interesting research, which he's talked about a lot recently. Bassem, thank you for your time tonight.
Hey, thanks, Ben, for having me.
You must have been, I mean, you've had a lot of response to this study. I guess a lot of people really wanted to know what you found.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question these days of how expensive an electric vehicle actually is in Canada. It turns out that it actually varies quite a bit in Canada, depending on where you live and how you live.
Yeah. How did you go about, what did you say? That was basically what you set out to find. How did you go about trying to find it? Because you're right, it's so varied. It depends on the vehicles. How did you go about trying to get some decent data here?
Yeah, so we look at what's called the total cost of ownership, right? So this includes everything from the sticker price, includes your operating costs. So for a gasoline vehicle, filling up gasoline, for an electric vehicle, charging your vehicle. We also added in the maintenance costs as well. We also looked at the resale value of those vehicles as well. So all of those put together kind of makes the total cost of ownership of the vehicle.
Right. And what did I think most people understand that every kilometer is cheaper in an EV than in a gas-powered vehicle, but lots of other things come into play as well. So I gather it turns out, and this really depends on where you live and how much you're paying upfront for that EV, but it's pretty varied.
Yeah, it varies quite a bit. So, if we look at where you live, so everything from your electricity prices to your gasoline prices, even the tax rate on your new vehicles, all of those have an impact. Even temperature as well can have an impact as well. But the biggest factor that we found is actually the rebates. Federally, there's about $5,000 or up to it that's available for all Canadians. But additionally, some provinces have an additional rebate. And so the biggest factor that we found is that those provinces and territories that have more rebates, those provinces tend to have more favorability for EVs.
Right. So I guess the big outlay on an EV is up front, right? I mean, therein lies part of the problem with EVs already is that, or so far at least, is that the cost up front is somewhat prohibitive for most car buyers. But what did you come up with just in terms of, I gather there was a lot around, well, with the rebates, but also a lot around just how much driving you did.
Yeah, there's a lot to do with the driving you did. So, I mean, if we do a comparison, right? So let's take, for instance, the Hyundai Kona. So, I mean, most people are kind of familiar with an apples-to-apples comparison. So if you kind of look at a Hyundai Kona electric version versus a gasoline version, and if you look at that over an average amount of time that most Canadians tend to own their vehicles, which is about 7 years, what we actually found is that the amount that it costs more per 7 years actually varies quite a bit across the country. So, for instance, in Quebec, it's about $2,000 more, but in Nunavut, it's about $18,000 more.
Oh, wow.
But if we look at it in the sense of how much driving you have to do, which is kind of a little bit more aligned with how most consumers tend to think, it could vary from, say, about 46 kilometers in Quebec all the way up to over 180 kilometers in Nunavut. So really the amount of driving right. that you'd have to do on a daily basis for those two vehicles to actually sort of equal in value or equal in the amount of cost that you'd pay over 7 years really varies quite a bit across Canada.
Right. I mean, obviously, the Nunavut thing, I gather that has a lot to do with just infrastructure and the cost and so on and so forth, and the cost of electricity, one would imagine.
Quebec, exactly.
So 46, so yeah, Quebec's pretty, that, but before, even 46 kilometers, I mean, not everyone drives 46 kilometers a day. In fact, I think the average commute's considerably shorter than that.
Yeah, you know, according to the latest StatsCan data that we have, which is actually a bit out of date now, it's about an average of 41 kilometers, if we just take Quebec. As sort of an example here, 41 kilometers. If we're looking at Quebec for the, you know, the break-even mileage that we looked at between a Hyundai Kona electric versus gasoline, it's 46. So it's actually not that far off from the average. And we actually think that the average has actually kind of gone up over the years, probably a little bit closer to the 46, maybe even a little bit higher. So in that sense, there's actually probably a lot of consumers out there, especially in Quebec, some of the other provinces such as BC as well, that we think that there's actually a lot of households that already meet that threshold to make those two vehicles cost pretty much the same over 7 years.
Right. Tell me a bit about some of the other provinces. Obviously, a lot of the listenership for this show at this time of night would be in BC and Alberta and Manitoba. What was it like in some of the Western provinces?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in Alberta, we kind of see things going the other way. There's obviously a lack of incentive as well. Actually, most recently, as we see the needle kind of moving the other way, with an annual tax being placed on EV owners. So it's a fairly nominal amount. I understand it's about $200. You know, it's sort of a drop in the bucket in terms of, you know, how much a consumer actually pays over the cost of the, over the lifetime of a vehicle and costs. But it is kind of moving the needle a little bit the other way. So, you know, in some of the provinces, such as Alberta, we kind of see things that are a little bit less favorable for EVs.
Right. And then in BC, I think that the even with the rebates here, the BC kilometers driven was relatively high. I think it was at 68?
It's about 64 kilometers, right. which is a little bit higher, again, than the average that a consumer drives. But, you know, sort of the main takeaway that we kind of have from our study is, look, you know, it doesn't necessarily make sense for a lot of consumers, but there are a lot of households that are already driving very large amounts, especially, you know, if you look at BC, a lot of listeners right now in BC, you know, in the Metro Vancouver region, for instance, driving very far distances towards, you know, the urban core, to where they work or play on a daily basis. A lot of people are already clocking quite a bit of mileage on a daily basis.
Bassem Javid is with us this half hour. He's a Cestral instructor and PhD candidate at UBC. He's led some research into EVs and just to put some of the dollars and cents around EVs. When does it become financially viable? I mean, or I suppose financially rewarding to drive an EV. And he's been talking a bit about some of the distances you need to drive in different parts of the country. 64 kilometers a day in BC. I think it's about 45 or 48. I might be getting this wrong in Quebec. But I mean, Quebec's pretty close. And a lot of this has to do with what you're paying up front. Bassem, when you looked at some of the, I was reading another article where you were interviewed, and you were sort of talking about having to change your expectations around sort of the size of vehicle you may drive to make an EV worthwhile in terms of dollars and cents, maybe having to go smaller than you would for a gas-powered vehicle, at least in the short term.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And this is one of the key findings that I think we really want to kind of show from the rooftops here that came out of our report. When we look at the, numbers like 64 kilometers a day or 180 kilometers a day, it's easy to get quite sober about EVs. I think one article even said, let's hit the brakes on EVs in Ontario, for instance.
Right.
One of the things that I want to say that, it's actually important to recognize that the comparison that they were making, Hyundai Kona gasoline versus a Hyundai Kona electric, that's a $25,000 car versus a $45,000 car. Most consumers don't actually shop like that. What we think is actually a much fairer comparison is based on your budget. So, for instance, let's say you have a $500 to $700 budget, which is about the average amount that Canadians who have a car payment make on a monthly basis. If you have that budget and you go into a dealership, you could either buy a Toyota RAV4, which is the most popular selling car in Canada at the moment, or with that same amount of money, you could buy a Hyundai Kona electric. One's a gasoline car, a little bit bigger, it's a compact SUV, or the Hyundai Kona electric is a subcompact SUV, a little bit smaller, maybe a little bit less luxury, but it costs the same amount up front. So what that means is that because of the benefits of an EV, of how they're cheaper to run, because I'm paying the same amount of money for either car, if I have the electric Kona, I'm actually saving money right off the lot, no matter how much I drive. And so that's actually a key point, the key message that we want to make in the study, is that, if consumers are actually willing to go with something a little bit smaller, but as long as it's electric, they could be saving, tens of thousands of dollars over 7 years.
Yeah, I guess that got a little buried in some of the reporting. But I mean, when I spotted it, I thought, well, that makes perfect sense. If you, so much of this has to do with how much you're dishing out up front, especially for the EV, obviously.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, EVs are definitely more expensive to buy at the moment. There are more affordable EVs that are slowly starting to come into the market. We will start to see more affordable EVs over the next little while, especially with the 2035 mandate coming up. That will sort of, incentivize us to move towards that. But the fact of the matter is that EVs are cheaper to run, right? They're cheaper to maintain and they're cheaper to run. And that's because they're more energy efficient. That's number one. And then number two is that when you actually compare the price of electricity to gasoline, in most of Canada, I think everywhere except for one province, electricity is actually cheaper than gasoline per unit of energy. And so for those two reasons combined, EVs are actually a lot cheaper to run than gasoline vehicles.
Yeah, it was a really interesting, the timing of it was great, and the way you went about it was fascinating. Anything surprise you in all this when you were said and done?
Yeah, I think that one of the biggest surprises for us was just how much money you could save in switching to a slightly smaller EV. And one of the questions that we got was, are we talking about going from something that's ultra luxury to something that's super basic, like say for example a Chevy Volt? And it wasn't even that; it was just sort of switching to perhaps one size category lower. And that was a bit of a surprising finding for us. And just the sheer amount of money that could be saved over a period of time, I think, is a really interesting piece that I think all Canadians should know about.
Yeah. Where to from here? I think what we're going to see over the next little while, although, there's always ebbs and flows in these things. So there was a whole bunch of excitement around EVs. Everybody was jumping on the bandwagon. Then I think some of the companies, certainly American car companies and some of the others, have been sort of trying to reassess this because it probably might not be going as well as they thought it would. But ultimately, if these mandates continue, we're going to see a lot more of them. We're going to see a lot more variety. I suppose in time, a lot of what you've done now is going to continue to shift as the price of EVs and the selection of EVs begins to change.
Yeah, definitely as the selection and the price of EVs changes, one of the things that kind of came out of our study as well is that it really highlights that there is a bit of a gap in the market for more affordable mass market EVs. Someone who's got about $45,000 to spend over car payments, whatever that works out to be, about $700 or so, they've got options for electric. But someone who's actually got the budget of a Hyundai Kona gasoline, which is $25,000, they don't actually have an affordable option at the moment. And so what this really points to is that there is a bit of a gap in the market. And if we do want to move towards the 2035 mandate that we have federally to meet, 100% of sales to be zero emissions vehicles, we'll really need to start seeing a lot more affordable EVs in the market.
Yeah. Well, Bassem, congratulations on the good work. I appreciate your time tonight.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben.
Since the beginning of 2024, you may have seen this, there were three more reported cases of measles in Quebec today. And really, Quebec has been the epicenter of all this talk of measles since the beginning of 2024. Five cases were reported in the region north of Montreal, which is called Laval. There have been 28 confirmed cases across the province since the beginning of 2024. And that's a lot of cases by Canadian standards. Again, the potentially serious disease is highly contagious, with some 90% of unvaccinated people possibly developing the disease should they come in contact with a case. There's been about 40 cases confirmed right across the country. And that includes in Quebec, as I was just mentioning, but also BC, Saskatchewan, and Ontario making up the rest. And there's concern, of course, because with the spring break coming, and that's part of the issue in Quebec, is they've already had their spring break, so people have already been traveling. There is always that risk that families will be exposed to vaccine-preventable illnesses making a comeback, including measles. Here's infectious disease specialist Dr. Isaac Bogosh.
It's only March, but we're already seeing tallies that resemble what we've seen from the entire year before.
Dr. Isaac Bogosh there. New projections suggest there is a high chance that this country may experience a, quote, sizable outbreak with anywhere from dozens to thousands of people infected if the disease strikes communities with low vaccination rates. The modeling suggests that vaccine coverage of less than 85% can lead to dozens of cases within small communities or even hundreds if immunization rates are lower, and that risk is even higher in more populated areas. Canada hasn't really seen an explosive outbreak this year. It has happened before. There were a whole bunch of cases in Quebec back in 2011 and in BC in 2014. The North American spike this year also follows massive outbreaks in Europe, with a 45-fold increase in cases there over the last little bit.
I think the more worrisome thing is what's happening globally. We know there's a large global resurgence of measles, and that means we're just at greater risk of importing cases into Canada.
So what does that mean for us? That modeling, by the way, was done in part by Carolyn Colane. She's a professor at Simon Fraser University and the Canada 150 Research Chair in Mathematics for Infection, Evolution, and Public Health. And she joins me now. Thanks for your time tonight, Carolyn.
Thank you.
There's been a lot of talk about measles so far this winter, and I think we're seeing not a sort of a huge spike in cases, but certainly cause for concern.
Absolutely. There are definitely more measles cases in the last year or two than there have been in previous years. In 2023, the EU reported around 30,000 cases compared to under 1,000 the year before, and that's continuing into 2024. So we're aware that there will be more introductions of measles cases into Canada.
Right. So we are seeing this. I mean, we have a bit of a warning sign here from what's been happening in Europe.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Tell me a bit about some of the modeling that you've done, because I think a lot of people are trying to figure out exactly what this might look like if, in fact, we start to approach what we've been seeing in Europe of late.
So what we see really is that most measles introductions will fizzle out, right? Because measles hasn't been spreading easily in Canada. We've had elimination status for measles, so we haven't had sustained transmission of measles in Canada since 1998. But we know that vaccination coverage is really variable across Canada. So while overall our coverage is good, around 90% of people are immune to measles, measles is incredibly infectious and it can get to that other 10%. But especially where there's a community or a school or a region where the coverage gets much lower than that. So what we wanted to do with modeling was see, okay, what if measles introductions do happen to land in an area or a community where there's low coverage? What would those outbreaks potentially look like?
I think I saw someone compare it to wildfires, right? If an area is particularly dry with lots of combustibles, then it catches, and measles would be the same from an immunology or an epidemiological point of view.
Exactly. That's right. It's so infectious that when it does get into a contact network, a group of people where there's enough people who aren't immune, then it can really spread extremely easily. After infection, there's some delay before people start to feel symptoms. And at first, it's kind of general cold-like symptoms. But then there's this kind of characteristic measles rash. But one of the challenges with controlling measles is that people can be infectious before, about 4 days before they get the rash. And so finding everyone that someone's been in a room with or in close enough contact, this is airborne, so you don't have to be super close. That's just really hard to do. So it makes it very hard to contain. Yeah, what we found with the modeling was really once, even with strong measures of trying to find people who've been exposed and trying to keep them away if they may have, they may become infectious, and offering extra vaccinations and so on. Even with that in place, when we get below about 70 or 65% coverage, we can see outbreaks, you know, into the dozens or even over 100 cases in small, close-knit communities, and potentially bigger in larger communities.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting a sort of a small glimpse of what that might look like with what's been happening in the province of Quebec, where, I mean, we're certainly seeing a lot more cases there than we've seen anywhere else. In fact, even on a continental, by continental comparison, the number of cases in Quebec is pretty high.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's reflecting travel for spring break. And so that, you know, with COVID, that happened a little later here in BC than in Ontario and Quebec for that reason. Hopefully we won't see large sustained outbreaks in our models. These can happen. They do depend on, you know, that kind of luck of the draw of whether measles introductions happen to arrive in communities with low vaccine coverage, and those communities being interconnected. So people who are not vaccinated or kids knowing other people and being in contact with others who aren't vaccinated, so that you have those chains of transmission. But because there's so much more measles globally, we know those introductions, they're just going to be more sparks landing on our grasses. And so where those grasses are dry, we just have those potential fires popping up.
Yeah. It was interesting to see, because I think we often look at overall vaccination rates and sort of decide from there how much the threat is going to be. But what you pointed out correctly, obviously, is that it does vary a lot. And there's some areas of the country where measles vaccination rates are very low.
That's right. We see where we have data, and, you know, data is always patchy and, you know, hard to see a complete picture, you know, for all the provinces. But where we do have data from BC and Alberta, we do see some schools and regions with below 50% coverage that's being reported, and many below about 80%. At the threshold for, you know, if you want measles not to take off and go anywhere, and you don't want to have to do anything about it that's expensive in terms of case finding and stuff, you really need about that 95% coverage. Or, you know, in our models, we do something. We don't say, measles, whatever. You know, we do try to intervene. And there, you know, with those interventions in place below about 70 or 65%, that's really where things can take off. But we do have jurisdictions and areas that are quite a bit below that.
Yeah. And when you're in your modeling, I mean, I think this is one of those things where there could be a delay. We mightn't see it spread. I mean, it's not COVID, right? It's not, but we could have sizable outbreaks in this country, similar, as you pointed out, to what we've been seeing in Europe of late.
Yeah. So measles was not eliminated or declared eliminated in Europe. So measles does spread what's called endemically in parts of Europe. So they would, you know, be likely to have more than we have. We hope, of course, that measles doesn't start to spread in Canada again, that we don't lose that elimination status. And I think that would require, you know, continued measles cases for 12 months, for example. So not just one big outbreak over a 3 or 4 month period, but sustained, you know, multiple outbreaks over a year. And we hope that that doesn't happen. But measles is incredibly infectious. And so if there are connections between those sort of dry wildfire-like pockets, then I guess it could happen. We hope that that we won't be seeing the kinds of numbers that we see in Europe.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I'm old enough to remember back when we got that elimination status and how hard people fought to get us there in 1998.
Yeah, it is tragic, right? You know, in January and February, I think in the EU, 7 people died from measles. No one needs to be dying of measles. This is a preventable infectious disease that we have the tools to really prevent. And I hope that we can do that. And I hope that, you know, people haven't entirely forgotten how serious an illness like measles can be.
Caroline Colain is a professor at Simon Fraser University. She's the Canada 150 Research Chair in Mathematics for Infection Evolution and Public Health. We're talking about measles cases. There have, of course, been new numbers out today in Quebec that show there's been another bunch of cases. Not a ton. I think it's above 30 now, but still, compared to what we've seen in years past, that is very high, highest in the country. We're also seeing pockets of cases in other parts of Canada as well. I mean, I suppose the easy answer here, Caroline, is just vaccination, right? I mean, this vaccine's been around for a very long time, and it seems to be effective.
I think that's right, especially in kids who haven't got their MMR vaccine or their measles vaccine or not up to date. That's really, measles is a childhood associated illness, and the risks are highest in kids under 1 year old and also higher in kids under 5, as far as I understand. So, and of course, measles, the measles vaccine is incredibly effective. It's about 95% effective. And even if there was a rare event where someone was vaccinated, did get measles, it's milder, it's less infectious. So really the risk is, you know, people who are not immunized or haven't had, if you're not immunized, but you've had measles before, like that also gives you some immunity. But yeah, that's the number one thing to do, especially for people who haven't had their measles vaccine.
Right. The two, right? Two doses as a rule?
That's right. Yeah.
What do you make so far? I mean, I've been reading a lot about it. It seems like governments or, you know, provinces are paying attention to this. What do you make so far of attempts to try to sort of make sure this doesn't spread?
Yeah, I mean, I think public health, there's definitely an awareness of the risk, and we've had outbreaks in Canada before. There was an outbreak of over 400 cases in BC a few years ago. There was one of over 700 cases in Quebec. Those are rare, and they tend to be associated, or they are associated with communities with low vaccination coverage. So I think public health are really aware that this can happen and hopefully are making preparations to do that work of, you know, identifying cases, asking people to isolate, inviting people to get their vaccines, and giving what's called post-exposure prophylaxis, which is treatment that right after exposure that can prevent you from getting full-blown measles and spreading it to others. So those things are in place. Those things are expensive and labor-intensive, and it's much easier, you know, all around if we can prevent the outbreak in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that comes to mind, too, with the situation we're seeing in hospitals. We're heading into the summer. It seems like the whole system is not ready for something like this to come along.
Well, yeah, I can't speak
not,
to the...
Sorry, not ready might readiness. Be the right word. The timing would be terrible. In other words, I guess there is no good time, but the timing right now would be particularly bad.
Yeah, I guess the peak of flu season would be worse. But indeed, there's no great time. I can't speak to the preparation of the healthcare system, but I can say that about one in five overall measles cases will need hospital care. So there can be an impact for hospitals, not just for the caring for the individual, but also preventing exposure in healthcare workers or in other patients who are in the hospital, because measles is so infectious. It's hard to contain in healthcare settings like everywhere else. So, you know, and also you don't want those, you know, among hundreds of potential cases, that's a fairly significant hospital need if it's around one in five. And like I said, that risk changes by age. So the exact profile of, you know, how severe it would be would depend on which communities and settings were actually affected.
Yeah. So given the modeling that you've done and the experience that you have, what is your message to Canadians now? Because I think a lot of people are worried about this because they're seeing the headlines. The cases are still by numerically relatively low, but, you know, you've already explained how contagious it can be. What would you tell Canadians right now as they look out over this heading into the summer?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, follow public health guidelines. I'm not in the business of making up public health guidelines. Mm-hmm. For those with kids who are not vaccinated or not fully protected, not with a two dose, definitely get up to date on those measles vaccinations. I think now is a really great time before those exposures start, before you're at risk, before it's kind of an emergency mode. I hope that we can continue, you know, for COVID, for measles, for any respiratory infection, to really support people to stay at home when they're sick. It sounds simple, but it's such a good way to prevent the spread of these infections. If you feel sick and you've been, especially if you've been traveling to a measles infected area, or you're in close contact with people who are sick and have been traveling, it's great not to, you know, go to the movies or go to the schools or the daycare centers or places where you might expose many people. So I hope that we can move in our culture generally towards not thinking, oh, it's okay, it's just whatever. Yeah, I was in, you know, an area with measles, but I don't feel so well, but I'm going to go and, you know, be in respiratory contact with 400 people. It can be very hard. You know, imagine trying to identify and phone everyone you've been in a room with in the last 4 days. It's really not possible. Even the ones you've been really close to or in a room for an extended period, it can be really hard to do. So I hope we can get those vaccines and stay home when we're sick and be vigilant and be aware of, you know, what to look out for.
I suppose when it comes to modeling such as you do, the real goal is to avoid the worst case scenarios that you've identified.
Yeah, our goal was to help people think through what this could really look like in Canada for the Canadian context. To think about, you know, how long outbreaks might last. Spoiler, that's kind of a, usually they're about 2 months in these models and in reported outbreaks, but of course bigger ones are longer. And, you know, to think about the really the relationship between those variable coverage and that size, when does it get kind of out of control into hundreds of cases versus, you know, most measles exposures will land on the wet grasses and not really go anywhere.
Caroline, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.